1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock. And I want to bring in Margaret Kennedy right away. Margaret, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Margaret, you went through a most traumatic experience, everybody's living nightmare when they hear about it. But a couple of years on, you're actually glad it happened.
I am. It sounds daft, but, you know, they inadvertently did me the biggest favour ever.
Okay, let's not tease people. We'll take them back and tell them what you're talking about. Tuesday, 15th of January, 2019. Where were you?
That's right. I was out. Myself and my partner were running a small dog minding and dog sitting business. And I was out with my youngest daughter out doing my customary dog walking. And we got a little delayed, so Paul ended up, we very rarely left the house at the same time, but Paul needed to do an errand, so he ran off to the bank. And when he arrived back, he phoned me, said, had I been home? I said, no, I'll be there in a couple of minutes. And he said, I think we've been burgled. And we had indeed. We pulled into the house, myself and Emily pulled into the driveway a couple of minutes later. I got out of the car, Paul was standing in the doorway. I just looked into the house and the very first thing I saw was a machete sitting on the stairs.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just horrendous, Katie. I mean, I felt violently sick. I just thought anything could have happened. That machete could have ended up in Paul. We had our own dogs and other dogs in the house. Anything could have happened. It just could have ended up so, so horrendous. We took our time and went through the house. We found a second knife up in one of my daughter's bedrooms. And it just really traumatised us both deeply.
Do you think now that Paul disturbed them? What had happened that they left they left the weapons behind?
Yeah. Yeah, we do. Paul arrived into the driveway and thankfully his mobile rang and he got out of the car and was walking around the garden talking on his phone before going into the house. It seemed when he got in, there were things dropped by the sliding patio doors. So it seemed like he was the thing that disturbed them and that they just took flight. That's what happened.
Right. Okay. So you called the guards, I presume?
We called the guards. They arrived at the house. They were just wonderful. They were absolutely wonderful. They were very kind and gentle with us. And they said, you know, that they did. Paul was the brave one and asked the question, did they think the people would have been prepared to use those weapons? And the guard just said, absolutely, you know, absolutely, you had a lucky escape.
God, it's just terrifying when you would talk about a machete and a knife in your daughter's bedroom.
Exactly. So we just were so rattled. We found we weren't able to sleep. We, you know, I'd wake up, turn on the light. Paul was already sitting up there. We were just so anxious. And
Margaret, just as you did they take anything valuable? Was that part of it? Or?
Oh, they took anything. They're not interested. The guards told us they wouldn't be interested in computers or technology or anything like that. They're looking for jewellery and they were looking for money. They were the two big things. We at the time were playing host to foreign students and. We had a little lovely little Korean girl who'd come to stay with us and they'd gone into her room, gone through all her suitcases and taken all her money.
Yeah.
And literally anything that they found, watches, they went through. My daughter had a big doll's house in her bedroom and they literally emptied all the contents of the doll's house, because apparently some people decide that's where they're going to hide their jewellery. So they knew where to go and what they were looking for. And they had such a small window of time. That's what was really scary, you know. We were always in that house.
Was there a sense that they had watched the house and that they knew, they saw that window opening?
That's the sense I had. But then I didn't know if I was descending into paranoia at that. But I did feel it was very, very unusual that, you know, between students, the dogs we were minding, and it was a busy house and there were always people there. So it just seemed strange that for one, I mean, it was literally less than half an hour the house was empty.
Right.
So,
and
yeah.
Was it just you? Did you hear that maybe neighbours had been targeted as well?
Not that day, but in the past, yes, there had been. I mean, we'd been broken into in that house previously, but it was nothing like that. It was, you know, somebody had come in, which is unpleasant, but this was just a very different, a different feel, a different experience. You know, this was frightening.
Again, obviously, because you saw what they came armed with.
Yes, yes, exactly. And you know, you just we just have to feel huge relief that nobody was hurt, or none of the dogs had a knife put in them as well. I don't think I'd have got over that.
Yeah.
Either, you know.
But anyway, this had a massive impact on you personally and on Paul and on your daughter.
Absolutely. Huge, huge impact. I just felt I can't live like this. And, you know, I woke up one of the nights and Paul was sitting there, I was sitting there, and I just said to him, within the back of our minds, we'd always kind of harboured the notion that one day we might go and live in France. And I just said to him, do you want to go and live in France? And he said, yeah. And
that was it?
That was it. We within a week, we had paid him a deposit on a house down near Perpignan on the border of France and Spain, without even seeing the house, without seeing the village, anything. But to be honest, we just felt anything has to be better than this. And we set the ball in motion, and a few short months later, we set sail with our two dogs and came over to live in France.
And, I mean, people might hear that and think, well, did you not bring your anxiety with you when you packed up?
Do you know, we did to a certain degree, you know, I mean, It left a mark on us. It left a big mark on us. But there was something quite therapeutic about just arriving somewhere that didn't have all the memories attached to it.
Yeah. And did you have any contacts, any friends, any relations, anybody on the ground in Perpignan when you got there?
No. No. Nobody. My sister and her husband live up in Haute-Savoie, which is about 7 hours' drive from us. But that was the closest that we had. We knew nobody in the area.
Brave move, Margaret.
Well, it was brave in a way, Katie, but, I mean, bravery involves an element of choice. And there were a few things, like, you know, obviously the fact of the burglary was the catalyst, but we were renting in Dublin, which was very, very difficult, very crippling. And the way the rental market works, you get a house for 1 year at a time. So if we were given notice to move house at the end of the current lease, we were looking at having to pay out between rent and deposit. We were looking at having to pay out maybe in excess of €6,000 to stay in Dublin. And we thought, you know, for that same amount of money, we were able to come to France and allow ourselves some money to live on for a couple of months and reinvent ourselves over here. So I'm not sure it was just bravery that did it. It was lack of options. And we've just been very lucky since we got here.
And so what are you doing there? What's your setup there now?
Well, when we arrived first, I was very lucky to... I joined a lot of the expat Facebook groups to try and put myself out there to get to know people. And they were very supportive, very helpful. One amazing lady, Elaine Rogers, helped me set up working as a virtual assistant, which managed to give us a steady income. But it also meant that I was able to go back. I'd for years aspired to write. I'd been writing novels that I'd never got really to over the final line. And this weekend I managed to launch 3 novels on Amazon.
Oh, congratulations.
I don't believe that would have ever happened if I'd been living in Dublin, because everything was geared toward just paying the rent. Whereas now I can divide my time and I can, as I say, I've realised what to me has been a lifelong dream of being able to physically hold 3 books I've written in my hand.
Wow, that is, that's impressive. And this is, how long, when did you actually move? When did you make the big move?
We moved here. We arrived here the 31st of August, 2019. So in less than 2 years, we've gone from, I suppose, zero to hero is how I feel it. You know, I very much feel, I mean, it sounds ridiculous. I get up in the morning, I look at the Mediterranean sun, I walk to the beach with my dogs, the 2 we brought with us and a little rescue we've just adopted. I come back, I do some of my VA work in the morning, and then I spend my afternoon writing. And
living the dream.
Certainly living my one, I can tell you. Yeah, I really am.
That is I'm sure many people out there listening to you today will think, I want your life, Margaret.
I know. And I, to be honest, Katie, I'm so grateful for it. There's not one aspect of it that I take for granted. I'm so grateful to be given this opportunity. And it sounds crazy, but you know, the gratitude even extends to the burglars, because only for them, we mightn't have done this for another 10 years.
I think you're probably the first person in the history of Liveline to come on and express gratitude to the people who burgled their home.
Well, you know, you can dwell on it and be angry or annoyed or whatever, but when we've borne the results of that episode to this degree, we're a lot happier to be grateful. That's how I feel.
And that sense you had, that fear, the waking up in the middle of the night, the anxiety and all of that, is that totally behind you now?
Yes, I feel so. In fact, I'm doing what would have been unheard of for me to be able to do 2 years ago. Paul is actually minding a friend of ours' house for a week, minding their 3 dogs, and I'm staying here in the house on my own, and I haven't had a sleepless moment. I feel completely rehabilitated.
Well, that is, you're a tonic to listen to you, Margaret, honestly. it's an extraordinary turnaround from what could have been a life-changing event in a very different way.
Exactly. Well, I have to thank Paul. Paul is the most positive person who's ever been in my life, you know. And, like, it's him that, I suppose, educated me to be able to put a positive twist on things. And I just feel the better for it, you know.
And your books, what type of books are they? What kind of writing are you doing?
I suppose how I'd class them, I'm doing what I call it a good holiday read. Can you hear me?
Yes,
sorry.
I don't know where that came out of, Margaret. A good holiday read.
I write under my maiden name. I write under the name of Margaret Cunningham. Can I mention my books? Can I mention the name of
books? Go on.
Okay. Well, my newest one is Clouded Issues. I have Doubler Quits and I have Metamorphosis.
And under the name of Margaret Cunningham, is it?
Margaret Cunningham, yeah. They're all on Amazon.
Okay, and I'm sure, as you say, a good holiday read, and that's what we're all looking for at this time of year. And Margaret, a lovely story, a great positive story, and best of luck. You've no intention of coming home from there now, have you?
Not permanently, but I hope to be able to visit regularly once all the restrictions are lifted. But no, to be honest, I love Ireland, but I love blue skies.
don't we all? Margaret, best of luck to you. Many, many thanks for that.
And thank you so much for having me on, Katie. I really appreciate
it. You're very welcome.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Sean Redmond, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, we were talking about a burglary there with Margaret, but you have another theft, but in, again, very unusual circumstances. You were taking your car for an NCT.
Yeah, and on the 26th of June, at about 10:30, I went up to the NCT centre in Ballymun, Unit 2, parked my car in one of the bays, went in, paid the money, went back out to the car. I was WhatsApping. I'm on a WhatsApp group. I was WhatsApping a few mates. And then this chap came over to me, dressed like one of the testers. And he told me to move away from the car, to go over where all the other people were waiting. So I looked over. There was six or seven people waiting along a fence.
So hang on, Sean, now. When you say dressed like all the other testers, what were they wearing?
Yeah, he had a similar sort of jacket on him. I'm not saying he was a tester, but he was dressed like one, you know.
Right, okay.
Dublin accent, very casual, you know, very calm. So I went over to where everybody was, and again, I'm on the phone, didn't notice anything. And then just lucky enough, this chap that was waiting as well, he noticed something, and he went over to the car and called it to the attention of a tester. And when I seen this, I went over, and I said, "Well, that's my car, what's going on?" And the chap that seen it said, "You want to get someone out here. I seen two lads at the car. They took something." So he looked underneath and he said, "They took the catalytic converter." I said, "You're joking me."
No way.
So he said, "Yeah." He said, "A car pulled up. Two lads jumped out. One of them jacked it up and the other cut it off with a grinder." He said, "It took about 30 seconds. He said, "That was it. They were gone."
So, and just to remind people, your car was actually parked in one of the bays outside the NCT centre waiting to get called in for its test.
Yeah, in the compound, in a parking bay, yeah. It was shocking. I was astonished, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and as you say, loads of people standing around waiting for their cars to get called in.
Yeah, but these boys were so quick. Like, I didn't see it. Only that chap was alert. Robert Cumberford was his name, thank God. He seen it, because I would have said, the only reason I knew, I would have known, was when I started the car and make so much noise. You know what I mean? But I would have thought the testers did it or something. You know what I mean? Or they would have said to me, "You know, your car is missing the catalytic converter. How did you get up here?" You know? But I didn't see anything. And then fair play to that chap, Robert. He went into the... He asked for the whoever was in charge, and they call him the leader. He came out, and he looked dumbfounded when Robert said it to him. And I said it to him, like, "Have you no security or, you know, anything?" You know, they had CCTV, but they said the person who had access to it wasn't there, and they couldn't show it or couldn't look at it. And then the chap said to me, the leader, he said, "You know," I said to him, "You know, what happened on your property? Are you not responsible?" And he just said to me, "I think you should call the guards." So I went outside, called the guards. Now the guards came up, I'd say, about an hour and a half. And I was left standing there. And then about a half an hour later, the leader came out. He just handed me a form. He says, "There's a complaint form." And that was it. He said, "Did you get a refund?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you can go in and get a refund." And he said, "It never happened up there before," which I thought, what? But when I went in and spoke to the girl behind the desk, she said the same. So I don't know how they knew or, you know, what went on, but they knew my Prius was coming in, you know.
The girl behind the desk said what to you?
No, the girl behind the desk said that it never happened up there before either. So that was two people working there that said that was the first time, you know.
I have to say it's astonishing because you would imagine, you say there must be CCTV in an area
they do have CCTV, but now they did say to me that they mightn't cover where I was, right? Which I found amazing. But I said to him, you have to be able to get CCTV footage of the fella who came over to me because it looked like he walked out of the main door. Now, we probably just, you know, did a little manoeuvre to look like that, you know.
But are you sure that that person was part of the gang that was involved in this theft?
Yeah, because he wasn't there afterwards. And why would he tell me to move away from the car? Like, normally when they come over, they take the keys off you and they drive the car in and test it, you know. He just told me to move off. Of course, I thought he was one of the workers, so I moved over. Now, don't get me wrong, I questioned him. I said, the guy said I was to stay at the car. And he said, no, you have to go over where everybody else is. So I assumed he was going to look at the car. Now, I never even thought that he didn't ask me for the keys or anything, you know.
Oh, yeah, he didn't. So, yeah, obviously, he would have wanted your keys if he was going to take the car in.
Yeah. But it was so quick. Now, I believe it's rampant. I heard Beaumont Hospital, Charleville, around Kilmore, anywhere, a supermarket car park.
Oh yeah, we've heard. I mean, obviously, I think anyone listening to Liveline will have heard over recent years that there are huge issues with this, where places where cars are parked. But I don't think we've ever heard a case of a car having their catalytic converter swiped while waiting to be to go in to get their NCT. Of course, you didn't get your NCT done. Then is the other thing.
I thought it was funny. The girl said to me, when you get your car fixed, you can come back in and get your test. He said, are you joking me?
And have you?
What's to stop them doing it again, you know?
Have you gotten the car fixed? Have you?
It's in getting fixed at the minute. It's going to. The first price I got was €1,500, and then the second price I got was €1,000.
Right. Well, there's another big question: €1,500 versus €1,000.
Yeah. And the first price, there was a 4-week waiting list. Apparently, they're very hard to come by at the minute. The second one, I think they're doing it at the minute, like, you know. But I haven't had the car since, you know, last Saturday. Saturday week, I think, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, Saturday 26. Week, yeah, the 26th. Yeah. Yeah, we just to say, we have a statement in from A Plus Inspection Services Ireland, the NCT people. They're confirming that the incident happened. The alleged theft has been reported to the test centre manager. However, as this matter requires full investigation, no further comment can be made at this time. We will fully support any Garda investigation that takes place. Have you heard any more from the guards, Sean?
Well, on a Monday evening, I went up to the Ballymun Garda station, and luckily enough, one of the guards that you know was on the scene was there, and he gave me the pulse number and all the details, and he said they'd be requesting. Like, they didn't even give the guards the CCTV. Well, they couldn't, but the guard said that they would be sending an email requesting footage of the CCTV. But I'd imagine the lads who did it would be false plates. It would be, you know. So I don't know. I can't see them tracing them, you know.
Yeah.
They were very professional, I have to say, to do what they did with the nerve of it, and then the quickness of it was unbelievable, like, you know.
You'd have to say nerves of steel, because they knew that you were just right there, like one way or another.
But any second, the tester could have come out to, you know, come to the car. And there was testers actually, you know, coming in and out to other cars, you know. Because it's all day ongoing, you know.
That is really, I thought I'd heard it all, but that is a new one on us. Sean, hang on one second. I think we've got Audrey. Audrey, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you? Good afternoon.
Yeah, now, it didn't happen to you at the NCT Centre.
No, when I was about 3 years ago, we went up to IKEA on a Sunday afternoon. And when we came back out to the car park, they had done the same to ours, taken the catalytic converter from it. A girl ran over to us and said that two fellas got out of a car underneath, 2 seconds they were gone. And then when my husband got into the car, it was a high Jeep. I think when you have a higher car, it's easier to get at. And there was a terrible noise when he was trying to start it, and then he realised what happened. But it's like, it's happening everywhere, I think.
Yeah, it does seem to be. Yeah. It's
I wouldn't mind.
No, go on, Audrey.
No, I wouldn't mind. On the way out, I lost my cardigan, a lovely cardigan that I loved. And I said, oh, I have to go back in and trace my steps. I said, we should never have gone back in for that cardigan. But
You were in for the cardigan that the catalytic converter got?
I don't know. Maybe. We were on our way out and I went back in. So we were a while in there. And it was a Toyota, you know, Jeep. So it was high up. I think it's easier for them to get at or to get underneath it.
Yeah, I think it's the brake maker car. Sean, what did you say you were driving again?
A Toyota Prius, and apparently whatever's in the Toyota Prius catalytic converter is worth a lot more. I believe that it's worth €600 what's in it, where the others are worth 100 or 200. So the Prius is highly prized, you know?
Yeah, ours was worth about, I think they said insurance about 1,000. And there was a car
I was talking about the robbery value of it.
Oh, no. There was a car stopped at the in Belfast or somewhere going onto the boat, and it had 13 of them in the boot at the time, the police told us.
Yeah, I suppose that's the market for them. They go across the border.
Probably.
Sean, is that what you've heard as well?
No, I read a thing in the paper the other week and they found thousands of them in some, I don't know where it was. Worth €200,000 or €300,000, you know, in a storage place. But I tell you, them lads that did that should apply for the job in Formula One. They'd make more money, you know.
They should be in the pit. They should be in the pit. Sean, thanks for that. We'll take a quick break.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815. Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Now, Dara McGann. Dara, good afternoon.
Katie, good afternoon.
Dara, you were listening to us on Friday and we were talking to that delivery driver, Rian, who was saying it was just so difficult for him to do his job now because of all the extra things that are thrown in the way of parking in front of the places he has to do his deliveries to. And you're a taxi driver.
I am indeed, amongst a lot of other things as well, yeah. But I was listening to Seamus, who rang in a reply, and Seamus was suggesting to Rian he should just park on the main road and block up all the traffic. And I was on my way to Clonakilty to see a psychologist, and I was going red in the car because I'm thinking, as a taxi driver or any other drivers, you could be doing an emergency run to a hospital, and particularly during the pandemic. And I'm thinking, are you serious? Stop the traffic to do a delivery? I mean, there would be anarchy on the roads.
Yeah, he was very serious about that, actually. And I mean, he was making his point at that stage in that conversation was, you know, why is it always pedestrians and cyclists that have to be discommoded? Why not drivers? Why are pedestrians and cyclists at the bottom of the pyramid when it comes to deciding who gets precedent on the roads?
Yeah, but you see, I think there's a bit of joined up thinking should be had, certainly in the major urban areas. And I've seen it in some places where deliveries are done within certain hours. So to avoid that sort of carnage, if you want. But yeah, certainly, look, we're in strange times. We're doing a lot of outdoor dining and all that sort of stuff. So we have to have a bit of give and take.
Dara, you mentioned there that you were on your way to a psychologist when you were listening to us on Friday. And I know people might know your name actually from Britain's Got Talent and other places. And you have a lot going on in your life right now, Dara.
And incidentally, I'm the last person to have performed the national anthem in Croke Park when Dublin were last beaten in the All-Ireland Championship. That was 2014.
And I was in Croke Park.
Yeah, but there is a lot going on in my life for that day.
Dara, we'll explain to people where you're coming from. So, take us right back to the start, Darren.
Yeah, I suppose, look, when I was growing up, certainly in my early years of 7, 8, 9, I always knew there was something wrong. I felt so different. Now, I went to an all-boys primary school, but I used to get bullied a lot. I used to be called sissy a lot, and I never understood what it meant, and I felt I couldn't come home and talk about it. But when I went into my puberty years, that's when it really hit home. I absolutely hated everything that was going on, the physical changes and all that, and I started to self-harm. I hated my body, I hated me. I knew there was something wrong, but I didn't know who to talk to, and I certainly didn't feel I could talk to my mum, because I would have come from a very religious family. And it just kept building and building. I went to train to be a priest 3 year when I finished secondary school. That wasn't for me at all. Again, I was in an all-male surrounding, and yet I still knew there's something not right.
And when you say, what year are we talking about now? Are we talking back in the 90s?
Yeah, we're back in the late 80s, early 90s. I'm 48 now.
Okay, so there would have been very little discussion in media or in culture generally about this kind of an issue.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, we only have to go back to 1993. Prior to that, homosexuality was an offence. And that's only one side of LGBTQI and all that community. Mm. Yeah, there was nothing at all ever mentioned about anything to do with that. I do recall the term transvestite being mentioned. Again, I didn't really understand what that meant. Now, later on, as I discovered what it meant, I knew that wasn't me. This isn't a temporary thing for me at all. And I remember chatting to Ryan Tuberty a couple of years ago, and I was talking to him about my mental health. And I had actually planned my own suicide the day after my 20th birthday. And if I'm truly honest, that was the reason, because I felt so trapped inside. I just felt I can't deal with this pain. I can't cope. Nobody will understand. There's nobody to go and talk to. And I just planned to get out.
And what stopped you? What saved you?
It sounds so simple yet profound. On my birthday, another RT broadcaster, Alf McCarthy, was broadcasting from the Cork studios. And somebody, I don't remember who, but somebody sent in a request for Darren McGann for his birthday. And he played Matt Monro singing The Impossible Dream. I actually listened to that entire song, and it was that song that actually saved my life. There was a line in that song, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. It just struck with me that day, maybe this is it, I'm actually in hell at the moment, and if I can get through another day or another day, I'll get into that heavenly cause. It seems simple now, but that's what actually got me through and helped me not to go through what I had planned.
Extraordinary. Like, literally, a song changed your life or saved your life.
It certainly did. And anybody that knows me knows that music is very much part and parcel of me. And I suppose that transformed my musical life in many ways, because I would identify with songs that I could reach out and touch people. But still, I wasn't dealing with what was going on inside.
And how long more before you actually, you know, understood really to begin with and then started to deal with what you needed to do?
I would say I'm going back to about 2009. That was around the time that I had been on the Seoighe show on RTE, and I met with somebody in Dublin who was in the transgender community. And she gave me an opportunity to come to Dublin and get all dressed up to go out. But the thing is, once I saw myself, all makeup and everything, I fell on the floor in tears. I was crying my heart out because I was finally seeing me. And the person I always knew was there. You see, I used to always wear a facial beard because I couldn't bear to look at myself in the mirror because I could see the woman looking back at me, and it just caused so much pain. After that experience, I got with a clinical psychologist in Clonakilty who specializes in gender issues. And my first encounter with her would be about 12 years ago now. And I remember that first hour with her, I cried my heart out. And at the end of it, she said, "You probably want to know what's wrong." I said, "Yes, I do, please." Well, she said, "I'm here to tell you there is nothing wrong, but I'm here to confirm to you that you are transgender female." Katie, to hear that, those words coming out to me, knowing that I wasn't crazy, I wasn't going mad, that was just a liberation in itself.
And you knew that that was it. That was putting a name on what you had felt for all those years.
Oh yeah, I knew, but it was to get that sort of like a clinical diagnosis for whatever your illness is, but it's not an illness. But just for that to be confirmed to me, it made me feel complete to a point. I knew there was a further steps to take, but just to hear that was just amazing.
What, like, again, yeah, I cannot imagine, actually. It's such a profound moment for you. But you must have also known at that moment, that you were now going to be embarking on a very challenging journey.
I did, and I knew that the biggest issue that I had, and I don't mean say this in a negative way or in a bad way, but it was my mum, because I live with her, I care for her, and I didn't know how she might react. And that fear of not knowing how she would react actually, put me back in, to use that term, the closet again.
Yeah.
Even though I kept attending the psychologist, I attended her for 10 years straight, once a month. And that kept me grounded. But I knew I couldn't transition. Well, I felt I couldn't transition, that mum mightn't accept or my family mightn't accept.
And had you had any kind of attempt to broach this with your mom at this stage?
I tried to broach the subject a few years back, but once it got to the crucial stage, I chickened out. And mom had been going through a period of ill health, and I just felt, no, I can't do this to her. So then I had made my mind up, right, do you know what, I know who I am. I'm not going to do anything until she passes, because I don't think she could cope. How wrong I was. Because last August, we did a staycation in Kerry for a few days. I don't know, I can't put my finger on it, but something changed during those few days where I felt, you know, maybe she is ready to hear this. So we came home, I went to see my GP, who was her GP, and, of course, with the face covering on, you can't see a person's expression. But as I was telling him the story, I could see him smiling. I said, "Doctor, what are you smiling at?" He said, "You're doing great." I said, "Doctor, tell me. Dara, I know you all my life. I've always known you were transgender, but professionally, ethically, I couldn't tell you. Why did it take to this stage?" Excuse me. And I said, "I'm worried about Mum." He said, "What are you worried about? Sure, she knows." I came home that morning. I sat down with her. I said, "I have something to tell you, Mum. I should have dealt with this a long time ago." And I started into my story, and I could see her smiling and her eyes welling up. And she said, "Dara, do you not see the weight lifting off my shoulders? I always knew this about you since you were a child. But you must understand," she said, "in the 80s, the 90s, even the early noughties, who could I talk to? Who could I go and say something to? They'd think I was crazy."
And did she say why she hadn't said it to you?
She was afraid. She was afraid because she didn't know the right words.
And she was not in any way...
frog in my throat.
But Dara, she wasn't. She was relieved that you were able in this situation now talking about it.
Yeah, very, very, very much relieved. And she said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "Mum, I have to transition. I have to be me." Well, she said, "Get on with it." But she said, "I'll give you two pieces of advice. Always dress elegant." I said, "Okay, I can do elegant." Secondly, and probably more importantly, when the time comes for you to have augmentation done, don't go too big, because they'll sag.
Wise woman, indeed.
I said, "Well, Mummy, unfortunately, I'll be getting implants and they don't sag." And she said, "Well, where were they 30 years ago?"
What age is your mum, Dara?
Excuse me. Yeah, she'll be 87 the end of August.
God, she's wonderful, isn't she?
She's my rock. Sorry. She's my rock. I wouldn't be here without her. She adopted me as a baby, and I've never met anybody as strong as her to have gone through so many things and to be there for me right now. She was in hospital over Easter. I thought I was going to lose her. Thankfully, I didn't. And when she came home, she said, "Dar, I'm not going anywhere until I see my daughter transitioned."
Dara, I'm going to take a break here. I want to hear the rest of your story. I'll just give you a chance to clear your throat there and take a breath. But we'll come back with the rest of your story after these.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And we've been talking to Dara. Dara, your mother to say that she's not going anywhere until she sees her daughter transition. That in itself, you'd carry that line with you for the rest of your days.
Absolutely, because I know when I came out to her first and I explained everything, a few days afterwards she was feeling a bit down. I said, "Mum, what's wrong?" "Oh, I don't want to upset you." I said, "Mum, what's wrong? Tell me." "Oh," she said, "it's just dawned on me. I feel as if I'm losing my little boy. I feel as if I'm losing my son." I said, "Mum, you're not. What you're actually doing is you're gaining his twin sister." And she looked at me and she said, "Really?" I said, "Mum, I'm still the same person. I'm just now being the authentic me that I always was on the inside. And I need to be me to be happy." But she said, "I've never seen you happier. So stay in that place."
And where are you with it now, Dara? What? That was when? Remind us again.
That was the end of August last year. So I'm under the care of a consultant in Drogheda, an endocrinologist, and he is responsible for the medical side of the hormone replacement therapy. So I'm 10 months into hormone replacement therapy. And as I say to people, the first lockdown with COVID was fine. We were all in it together. The second lockdown couldn't have come at a better time for me, because, Katie, you'll appreciate this. When we're hormonal, we need to stay away from silly people. So second lockdown was fantastic. I'm progressing well. My psychologist said to me on Friday that she was so impressed with me, that I was really embracing it all. Now, look, I'll be honest, there has been a bit of negativity, of course, but that's from strangers, from people that don't understand.
And where are you experiencing the negativity?
Well, the Irish Independent did a piece on me a few weeks ago for Pride Month about my story, and when they put it up online, there were a few trolls that had their little piece to say, you know, nameless, faceless people. But I always knew that that would happen. But I like to think that I'm at an age now where I can sort of ignore that. I can brush it off. But I do know a lot of younger people in their late teens, early 20s who are transitioning. And they're still experiencing transphobic behavior, which I think is so, so sad. If it's not affecting you, why do you need to comment? Live and let live.
Yeah, but I mean, it is like the whole discussion around transgender is so open now compared to even, I would say, 4 or 5 years ago. It's the debate has been transformed. And I know it's quite divisive and it can be quite difficult for many people. But it's being spoken about, at least. I mean, that must be a huge step forward.
Well, and more than that, I know of many schools, even schools in my own area, where there are young people now as early as 13 or 14 who are now coming out and are beginning to transition. And that's absolutely fantastic. But I my concern is for all those who haven't been able to do that or who are still trapped or they feel they can't go on. I just want them to know that there is a tomorrow, there is a today, you know, and there is help out there, there is hope out there.
And okay, so you're what do you say there, 10 months down the line now with the hormone therapy. What comes next for you?
Well, my psychologist tells me that by the middle of next year, I should be in a position to go for augmentation surgery.
Right.
And probably 12 months after that then for the reassignment surgery. However, unfortunately, there are no surgeons in Ireland that will actually operate for on transgender people. So
none at all. You cannot get the surgery in Ireland.
You cannot get the reassignment surgery in Ireland at all.
And can you get referred for that surgery?
Yes, the HSE will refer you to, there's a hospital in London, Charing Cross. Now, I'm not sure if anything has changed since Brexit, but the HSE will refer you to another, to a hospital in another jurisdiction. But I just think it's sad that we don't have that facility in Ireland.
And do you have to do this privately, or will this come under, will the HSE pay for this?
Well, you see, I also have multiple sclerosis. So I'm under the care of the HSE for that, and they will automatically kick in. But, I mean, I had to go and see the consultant privately.
Right, so it's sort of a private public. But you won't, I mean, I imagine this kind of surgery would be hugely expensive if you had to pay for it yourself.
I'm led to believe that the reassignment surgery could be anywhere in the region of 30 to 40,000 euro, which
right.
is a lot of money to, you know, to a lot of people.
But you won't be asked to pay for that yourself?
No, the HSE will cover that. There is a budget from the Department of Health to cover those that are transitioning from both male to female and female to male.
And so that is, what timeline were you saying you're hoping maybe next year?
I would be hoping next year for the augmentation, breast augmentation surgery, and then probably 12, maybe 18 months after then for the reassignment surgery.
And is it a thing that you can't wait to get to that place, or is there, you know, some trepidation, you know, or do you feel you need that time working your way up to this now?
Oh, if I had my way, I'd get it done today. I just can't wait. But look, I'm a realist as well. I know there's a preparation time as well. You need to get the testosterone out of the body, get the estrogen levels up. I have a lot of weight to lose. There were some trolls online saying that. I know they were right, absolutely. But, yeah, look, I'm just enjoying this time. I'm enjoying this transition. I've never felt happier in my life. And the most important thing is that it's not going to affect my singing voice. Yes, I will be working on my speaking voice, but my singing voice will never change.
And you haven't changed your name either, Dara.
Well, I changed the spelling, and the reason for that is that I love my mum so much, and she was so good to give me that name, Dara, when she adopted me.
And of course, it could be either male or female.
Yeah, it's gender neutral. So I just changed the spelling from D-A-R-R-A-G-H down to D-A-R-A, and that's gender neutral. And on my Facebook page, I have Jan, which is short for Janet. I just always loved that name. So Dara Jan is what I have on Facebook. But look, people call me Dara, they call me Dara. Sometimes they call me worse, but Dara is my name. And I didn't want to offend Mum by changing that.
And are you looking after the 10 months of hormone treatment? Do you look differently now? Are you liking how you look now?
Well, no, I'll be honest. I need to shed a lot of pounds, absolutely. But that's medical related. I'm loving how I look. The charity shops have really benefited from me in the last number of months because all the, inverted commas, male clothing is gone. It's been donated. And I'm just loving it. I've a constant smile on my face. And unfortunately, with face coverings, you can't see the smile.
And are you going by your mother's advice and you're being very careful to dress very elegantly at all times?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes, yes. I'm a lady. I try my best. Look, we've had no opportunity to go out and do otherwise, so
yeah.
I'm just dressing down at the moment.
Right. We have, do you mind if we hear your extraordinary voice, Dara? I think we have a clip of you singing on, is it from Britain's Got Talent? Yeah, from Britain's Got Talent. Do you mind if we play listeners? Just to remind people.
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah, because it is absolutely beautiful. Will you play it there?
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling. Oh, Danny boy, oh, Danny boy, I love you so, but I shall hear the soft you tread above me, and all my cares are warmer, sweeter be, and I shall sleep in peace until you come.
Oh my God, Dara, I have goosebumps. I have actual goosebumps. What a stunning, stunning voice. That you're telling us that's not going to change?
No, I mean, a lot of people ask me that question, will your voice change? And luckily, no, from a singing perspective, your voice would only change if you were female transitioning to male. The testosterone makes your vocal cords deeper. For me, I need to get with a speech and language therapist to work on the pitching of my speaking voice, but my singing voice isn't going anywhere. It's so important. And thinking back to Britain's Got Talent, that was just a magical experience. My mum was with me right the way through. She met Anton Deck, and we were treated like celebrities up there, which we didn't expect at all. And to sing Danny Boy in Belfast, the people's song, and I was thinking of Barry McGuigan's father, and I know his daughter received an IFTA there last night, posthumously.
I think anyone that heard Barry and his wife on the radio this morning would have been very moved, would have seen from their
Absolutely.
Contribution last night.
But his father sang Danny Boy before his fights because it was a neutral song, it was the people's song, and to sing it in the waterfront in Belfast, and then for people to come up to us afterwards, to Mum and I, it meant an awful lot. And I was so proud, you know, to be Irish, and I was so proud to be there.
What was Simon Cowell like?
Simon was absolutely fantastic. They do their research, they do their homework, because in the middle of our... I was initially speaking with Alicia Dixon, and then Simon brought it in, asking me, did I have any pets? And I did have a little dog named Charlie at the time. And he got into a conversation with me about Charlie. After the audition, I was brought backstage to Stephen Mulhern for Britain's Got Extra Talent. And the cameras are rolling and he said, wouldn't it be great if we could ring your house and talk to your dog, Charlie, on the phone? Now, a cousin of my mum was house-sitting or dog-sitting for us. I rang from my phone, and my cousin called the dog, and she came back and said, "I'm sorry, Dara, he's chewing a bone." So Stephen Mulhern said to her, "Well, Mary, maybe you could be the dog." And he had her barking down the phone. But it was such, Katie, that was just an immense, incredible experience. I got to sing in Croke Park then for the All-Ireland Football Semi-Final, Dublin-Donegal in 2014 on the back of that. And my next outing from a big perspective was on RTE Saturday Sport. I sang in Parky Cueve for the opening of Parky Cueve, and then again for the Liam Miller tribute match, I got to sing Aran na Bhfian with the Barrack Street Band.
So are you hoping to get the phone to call to ring again now once they start letting people back into the stadium?
Well, the person that trained me to perform Aran na Bhfian was the late, great Cara O'Sullivan. Cara worked with me on RTE's Seoige programme, the Do I Dare Challenge in 2009. And at the time she said to me, "Dara, I want to see you singing Aran na Bhfian in big arenas." Unfortunately, Cara passed away last year.
Yeah, and a desperate loss.
A terrible, terrible loss. But the first phone call I received after singing in Croke Park was from Cara with "Doubt You By," "Good Luck," "Well Done." So, look, I'm just delighted that my singing voice is still there. I have an album completed with Mark Cahill and Navin. It's completed with over a year. Looking forward to getting that out there and combining the whole lot. And I'm just so grateful for where I am and grateful for my mom and for the support I've received from all my family.
Yeah, well, your mom in particular just sounds like such an extraordinary woman. It's so lovely to hear, you know, how she came to terms with what was going on with you and the great support she's given you. And there you are now dreaming the impossible dream. Dara, thank you so much for telling us your story today.
Katie, it's been a pleasure. And before you go, can I just say a big shout out to yourself and Sarah McInerney, because I do not envy any politician that will go on Drive Time or Saturday with Katie Hannon, because you're some women, I tell you, you really put them to the sword.
Thank you, Dara. Thank you. We'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Now, last week, we were talking about this whole idea of downsizing and people feeling that they were being pressured into downsizing after their families were reared and moved on, and feeling like, you know, what right did we have to tell them where to live? I want to go to James now. James, good afternoon.
How you doing, Katie? Good afternoon.
Now, you tell me your own story. You're living on your own now.
Yeah, I live here. It was originally my family's home, my parents' home. Back in the early 1970s, there was another housing crisis at the time. So I think Dublin Corporation at the time decided that they needed to build houses fast. So they built this estate where I am now, and my parents got the chance to rent one of these houses. And at the time, it was my parents, my eldest sister, my eldest brother, and then my other sister, who was only a baby at the time. So they were here, and then I came along then a few years later on.
You were the baby.
I was the baby. That was 50 years ago this year. So eventually, when my father passed on and then my mother passed on a couple of years ago, so I was here. I took on the house.
You took on the house, but you took on a lot more than the house,
James.
I did. James.
Well, I was a carer for my mother for 14 years.
14 years?
Yeah. Now, when I say a carer, Katie, she wasn't ill at the time. She had mobility issues, and it was just for someone to be here in case she fell or if she needed assistance going up the stairs or that.
Helped her, of course, to stay at home and maintain that independence.
Oh, of course, and that was the agreement that we said. You know, we always said that we would never, if we could, we would never have her in a position where we couldn't keep her here. at home, because as great as nursing homes are, there's no place like home. You know, there is no place like home, especially when it was her home for near on 50 years.
Yeah. So you were the sibling who was, as you say, the youngest, and the others had gone on ahead and gone on and had other homes,
yeah,
and other lives. So you were the man left at home in this situation.
Yeah. About 2 years before my mother passed, she was diagnosed with cancer of the stomach. And, like, it was tough. You know, it was tough. You know, to deal with that, considering that she had been in good health otherwise, apart from mobility issues.
Then you become a carer, a full-time carer, really, do you?
A full-time carer, yeah. Yeah. Which has its own, you know, it has its own difficulties as well. Because you're not only, you know, you have to be kind of like a nurse as well as, you know, trying to look after the house, you know, trying to look after your own life as well.
That's the issue. Were you in another relationship at this stage, or?
No, I wasn't up until I only met my partner in 2014. And as it happened, she had been in the same situation that I was in. She had cared for her mother as well before she passed. So she knew exactly where I was coming from, you know, and all the struggles and the, you know, the day-to-day issues that you come across when you're looking after someone.
Well, especially if you're a single man, you're looking after your mom, as you say. So, you know, that's a lonely enough situation in many cases. But it does then hamper your ability to go out and meet people. And
it does. But again, it's what you sign up for as well. You know, you sign up for this because, you know, our parents look after us when we were children. So you're it's kind of like payback in a way. You know, if you can do anything to help them in their later years, then that's what you do. And I think any family member would do the same, and any family.
So your mum passed. When did that happen, James?
She died in April, the end of April 2018.
Right. And now you live alone in this family. What was your family home?
Yeah, I live here. Now, my partner obviously comes up and we spend a bit of time here together. But the house is mine. And I've took it on and I've made it my home, basically.
And is it what, a two-bed or a three-bed?
It's a three-bed.
Okay, so what would you say to somebody who would say, look, there's families with young children who could do with a three-bed house. Do you need to be living in a house with three bedrooms in it on your own?
I would say, but you have to look at it this way, Katie. I mean, I've been here, you know, I'm 45 years old and I've lived here all my life. I've known people here. I've grown up with people. There's a great community here. You know, to take someone away from that, I think would do harm, more harm than good. And I realise there is a housing crisis out there. I mean, we hear about it every day. But I don't think it's the answer. You know, especially older people who, you know, who, in fairness, you know, they've paid their mortgage. They've had the same struggles as everyone else. Even back in the time, like I remember back in the 80s where I think interest rates were a hell of a lot more than they are even now. And, like, people still have to pay mortgages and the likes. But I think to kind of, even to try and force someone to make that decision, I think is wrong.
Yeah, well, I suppose I should say nobody's, you know, there's no suggestion right now that anyone is being forced to do it.
No, there
isn't. But it was put out there again politically in the last month or so that this should be part of the mix, that people should be, as I think the word used was, incentivised to downsize or to right-size. That's a new word for this, James, right-sizing.
Right-size, Yeah, that's a new one on me now, I'm afraid, Katie. I've never heard of that one before.
But it
may suit some people, and it may not suit others. And I don't think it'll suit a lot of people, to be quite honest.
Yeah. James, I think I have found, just bear with me, I think we might have one person who did find it a positive experience.
Yeah.
Norma, good afternoon.
Hello, Katie. Thank you for the opportunity to come on and talk about this. It's something that's quite dear to my heart. I was listening to, it's James, is it?
James,
there, yeah.
And I do sympathise. And actually, one of the reasons I ended up downsizing was because of something I saw in my early years. My mother was only 63 and she had a massive stroke. And they were living in a kind of a Victorian house where everywhere were stairs. And I suppose I was very young at the time. I was in my early 20s. And I was quite traumatised by what I saw happening at home because the house was so unsuitable. And I also saw what can happen overnight. And I suppose I'm not suggesting for a moment that anyone should have to do this, not for a moment. But I do think there are great benefits to downsizing. But what James was saying there about, like, my benefits, I did it in 2014. I sold up a four-bed with a garage and a conservatory, and I moved into a two-bed council house, and I had it renovated. And I did it for reasons to future-proof my life. I did it so that my utility bills, my property tax, all of that would be smaller. I literally sat down with a notebook and pen and said, well, okay, what do I need in my future?
You're a young woman, though, Norma, I know from your voice.
I was in my late 50s at the time, but that would be one of the reasons, Katie. I remember I was sitting, my brother hears this now, he'll go crazy, but I was sitting, he's 5 years older than me, and we were sitting one morning having coffee, and he said something, and I think he was about 61 or 62 at the time, and he said something, and I remember something went ping in my head. I said, I'll never have the courage to do this when I get into my 60s. I need to do it now. But what I would say is it was an extremely stressful thing to have to sell up, to clear out your stuff and move. But what James was talking about there about community, I think that's one of the biggest problems, particularly in Dublin, that I was living in Sandyford, Dundrum at the time, and there was nothing available in the area. And one of the reasons I was really so keen to come on and talk about this is where what I would like to see happening is the government to actually do some forward thinking and put together a group who might put a set of plans, like there are hundreds of thousands of three-bedroom semis in the country that are all more or less the same. And if you've got a team of architects together to actually do a plan, like most of those houses are about 1,000 square feet, you need 700 for a reasonably one-bedroom apartment. And if a good team of architects and builders got together, they could have an off-the-shelf plan for people where they could just go in and have an idea how much it was cost to turn a three-bedroom semi into a two different units, one upstairs and one downstairs. And the one downstairs then would be in the community that the person was used to.
Yeah.
And then they might have an opportunity of extra income upstairs. Yeah. I suppose I'm coming from the place where I'm divorced, and I would know people that are also divorced, particularly women, who might not have, shall we say, a decent pension going forward, but they might have a biggish house, and this would be an opportunity for them to future-proof their home and also have a good income.
Yeah.
So that's, Katie, where I'm coming from.
Norma, thank you so much for that. We're actually out of time now, and I know we have more callers waiting to come on this. We might be able to come back to this tomorrow. But James, I want to thank you and wish you best of luck in your situation there. And thank you, Norma. Today's programme was produced by Fergus Sweeney. Have I got my credits here? On sound, we had Damien Channels. Daniel Keating was our BCO, and Rebecca Meehan is the series producer. And stand by now for Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
1850 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.